Wisp Sports Radio, the voice of women in sport.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is season 2, episode 16. Listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with Wisp Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, director of the Tucker Center. In this podcast, I will talk to Dr. Victoria Jackson, who is a clinical assistant professor of history at ASU, otherwise known as Arizona State University. She is also affiliated faculty with the Global Sport Institute at ASU. Like many of us listening, and myself included, she's a former NCAA athlete, but she is also an NCAA national champion in the 10,000 meters and was a professional runner endorsed by Nike. So we are going to talk about her work. And I also want to cue in the listeners that she is a great follow on Twitter. Her handle is also awesome, @HistoryRunner. So follow her, and she has some great content on her Twitter. We have a lot to talk about. Welcome, Dr. Jackson.
Hi, thank you for having me. That was a wonderful introduction. I should just like have you introduce me all the time wherever I go.
Well, you can use the audio file and, you know, just have them hit play from now on. So where do we start? We have so much in common in terms of our interests, but also have some divergent areas of expertise. So how would you really describe the nature of your work?
Well, I'm a historian, which means I like to tell stories and I like to draw kind of conclusions, big ideas from those stories. And historians know there's many ways to tell a story, but that there is much complexity and contradictions bound up in history. And so, and primarily my first job on the faculty was teaching faculty. So when you're teaching lots of large lectures to people who haven't really thought critically about sport or using sport to explore history, a particular time and place in society, you have to learn how to tell good stories and to hit big ideas to keep students kind of not entertained, but really engaged and interested in the materials that you're teaching. So my work is, I mean, that's that teaching background is great training for kind of public speaking and writing and kind of general audience, public speaking and writing, like educated general public audience work. Mm-hmm. And it turns out sport is a really fun way to engage ideas like critical issues in society more broadly. So that's kind of where I play professionally, both teaching and then also engaging with public about these ideas about the past and how they're relevant to our present.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really admire about your work is your ability to translate history and historical happenings into the current moment and inform all of us in terms of how the past informs the present and perhaps the future. And I think there are scholars like yourself that are so good at that translational piece. So I would really encourage everyone to follow your work because you have some really great insights that as a critical gender scholar, when I read your work, there's things that I don't think of because I'm not a historian. So how would you think that your work intersects with gender since we're talking on the Tucker Center Talks and we do gender in sport? Where does your work intersect with gender?
Well, you know, my work is on the history of modern sport, and modern sport has always been a political project, and it's about power and who has power, who, kind of holds power over others. And if we're thinking about modern sport, it's born in a very important specific historical moment, which is post-Civil War, really post-Reconstruction, kind of reordering of the hierarchy of society, and it's white male supremacy that is kind of the political project of modern sport. And, you know, in the classes that I teach, in the work that I do writing for public, that's always kind of the grounding, that this first political project of sport was a project of exclusivity and a project of kind of reestablishing a hierarchy after emancipation. And gender plays an incredibly important role in that, because a lot of sports before this kind of origin political project moment were gender inclusive. Stick and ball games, Jennifer Ring's work on baseball, I think is so important to understanding how, you know, so much of what we take for granted is not actually just the way it always was, that people mindfully forced people out of sport, and baseball especially is part of that project. And within a United States context, you know, the kind of evolution from soccer into American football and that becoming a manly male sport, like we see elsewhere, the football was also gender inclusive, that girls and women played as much as boys and men. And the scholars who really do great work on that are Brenda Elsie and Joshua Nadel. Their book Football Era shows the massive popularity around women's soccer before this kind of politicizing moment, this power play moment. And I love that term power plays. That's Lindsay Gibbs's term. Mm-hmm. I think it's such a great way to capture how sport, something that's inherently something all bodies can play, becomes political because of these power plays. And so if this first political project of sport is white male exclusivity, white male supremacy, the next political project of sport is all those people, women, people of color, people of different gender orientations and sexual identities, those people fighting to gain access, playing on their own, right? Sports don't go away mm-hmm. when the power players force you out. You play on your own kind of in the marginal spaces, the liminal spaces, but then also trying to gain access to those legitimate spaces too. And then I think what we're seeing in this current moment is the third political project of sport, which is that sport is never free from, you know, what's going on in broader society. And it, right. because of all this political power, just this potent stuff, this richness in this space, using it to force change beyond the field of play, with the activism that we're seeing athletes taking on and leading in many cases, and women athletes especially leading for so long, doing the work behind the scenes in most cases, or the work that's not gaining as much attention from outsiders.
Yeah, I really like how you broke that down into three sort of political projects over time, and how the marginalized in our society have also been the marginalized in sport. And I heard recently on a podcast, well, actually it was a webinar that Brené Brown was doing. And of course, she always has a few great nuggets of wisdom because she's Brené Brown. But she was talking about power. And, you know, we're all sort of struggling with reimagining the system, right? The system needs to change. The structure of society, the structure of sport needs to change. And she said something I'd never thought of before, and I'd love to get your take on it. She said, the system is working exactly how it was designed by white able-bodied men. So of course, if we want to change the system, we have to interrogate male power, white supremacy, because the system was designed that way and it's working exactly how it was designed. And I had never thought of that. What do you think about that? It kind of intersects with your work and your thinking.
I guess that always gives me pause, because it almost gives more credit to creators of this system than they deserve. I think a lot of it is accidental, and just like conveniently so, I don't think there's necessarily some sort of like evil mastermind, like working to jerry-rig everything. Now, then also speaking as a historian, and like if we go to primary sources, like people writing about like how sport is, who it's meant for, who it's created for, and what purposes it serves in society.
Yes.
At the turn of the 20th century, absolutely. That's absolutely the case. That, you know, if for example, you're looking at a college football game in the southern states, so those colleges were all white, and not even for the players on the field, for the spectators, the lessons that they were learning from watching a college football game were lessons about Anglo-Saxon supremacy. And people were speaking explicitly about it then. They're not speaking explicitly about it now, but there's never been an intentionality to correct these systems to make them more equitable. It's these people who can do something for us are now also gaining access to this space, but the space is still created in a way where we're extracting value from those athletes for our purposes, which were originally projects of white male supremacy. So that part is, I mean, that it's probably saying the same thing, but in a way that's less punchy.
Right. Well, and that's what she's good at, is those punchy, pithy sort of remember this, this is important nugget. So speaking of kind of the current unprecedented moment right now in society and in sport of athlete activism and the disruption that at least professional athletes are now banding together with strikes and boycotts and campaigns and awareness and press releases and media, how do you see the role of the Black female athlete in this landscape, given the intersections of your work and historical thinking around the intersections of race and gender and social justice issues?
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing in the current moment is a through line since at least the 1950s. But if you're stepping outside of sport, long before the 1950s, of Black women doing the work, doing the foundational work, doing the organizing, doing the critical innovative thinking, reimagining what systems could look like that are more equitable going forward. And that's exactly what's happened in this moment as well. So, and I'm relying on historians Amira Rose Davis at Penn State and Lou Moore at Grand Valley State, who both do a lot of writing and have, Lou has two books on this topic, and Amira has a book in progress on this topic. And women have been erased, Black women have been erased from our narratives of athlete activism. And if you go and you look at any sort of narrative of athlete activism, until about 5 years ago, you really didn't see Black women playing core roles, core acting roles in these organizational efforts. And thanks to the work of Amira and Lou and others, where they are reinserting Black women back into this narrative, and not just as like, oh, and by the way, that this woman also is doing something. They're at the core, they're at the foundation. And like the tragedy, for example, of the Olympic Project for Human Rights, the boycott movement at first that then became the podium protest in Mexico City in 68 by John Carlos and Tommy Smith, they never thought to invite the women in to be co-collaborators in that movement. And yet those women were also talking, they were also organizing, they were also protesting. Wilma Rudolph, Wyoming Attias protested in Mexico City, just nobody talked about it. And going back further, the first person to do a symbolic act during the playing of the national anthem at a sporting event was Rose Robinson at the Pan American Games in Chicago in 1959. And so
nobody knows that. Oh, I shouldn't say nobody. Very few know that.
Right. Oh, and thanks to the work of, you know, current historians like Amira and Lou, we now know this, and we're seeing more responsible storytelling around this history. And you know, with this current moment, this unprecedented you know, movement and moment to pause professional sports in the United States and the way that we saw it happen, that's historically unprecedented. To protest racial injustice and the police killings and the extra legal killings of Black people in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I do think, because I saw a few women who are champions of women's sports and women athlete activists kind of annoyed that the narrative was that the NBA started that cause. But here's a case, and this is one of the things I always like to emphasize. As historians and as scholars, we always have to go local. And this is a local story of the Milwaukee Bucks and knowing this metro Milwaukee, Chicago region. Kenosha is right in that metro region, from Chicago to Milwaukee, which is the most segregated metro region in the United States. That Sterling Brown, a Milwaukee Bucks player who read the statement from their locker room, had been harassed and arrested by the Milwaukee Bucks just a couple years ago. Like that matters, that the Bucks started this. But it's again another example of a local grievance that very much becomes national. And yeah, I mean, absolutely the WNBA has been doing this work all throughout. So we can hold both ideas simultaneously.
I think that's good because I do think there was a lot of advocates of women's sport, myself included, that was sort of critical and saying, hey, you know, but the WNBA has been doing this and stop erasing, you know, the voices of women and the activism of women. They're doing it too, and they might have been doing it first. But you're right. I mean, it should be both and there's plenty of work to do in this space. So the more people that are doing it, the better. To draw awareness, and if that is our athletes, even more powerful because they have so much social capital in our society. Mm-hmm. Let me pivot a little bit away from that, and I know as a public scholar, you're giving lots of interviews and podcasts and writing op-eds and using your knowledge for the public good. So when you give talks, what are the three really sticky ideas that people latch onto? They're like, ooh, that's good. You know, kind of like the Brené Brown moment of, well, the system is working just as it should. It's like, ooh, that's good. What do people latch onto that we can sort of have our listeners take away from?
Well, the first I kind of outlined when we were talking about my work as a historian, and that is this idea about power. That ideas about bodies play out most explicitly on the bodies of athletes. Because sports are about bodies. So if you wanna go back in time to a particular time and place and understand how people in that community thought about gender, thought about race, go to the athletes and you're gonna find it like amplified, like on the bullhorn. And part of this also is that athletes are part, like it's not that they're just these blank slates and other people's ideas about their bodies are playing out on them. They're actively engaged agents in shaping the narratives and the understandings of their bodies as well. So if it's an athlete existing in a particular moment and the way others are using their body is not in line with the way they feel their body in the world or the way they want to change that broader society, athletes are often going to be on the front lines of contesting and challenging those ideas.
Interesting. Now, you know, the thing pops into my head right away, I'm trying to think of a concrete idea. To bring this to light is I'm thinking of Brandi Chastain in the 1999 Women's World Cup. She's in the moment. She takes the final penalty kick. She tears off her jersey and we see the sports bra and she's showing her agency then that also was given meaning. on her body about what does that mean for women in sport and gender in sport and women's rights, et cetera, et cetera. So that just popped into my head as you were talking. Okay, so that's sticky idea number one, that the bodies of athletes can tell us something about ourselves and our society in that historical moment. Okay.
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
Number two.
The second is that, so I've been saying how sport are kind of a reflection of the broader issues of a society. I think this is a way of getting at a corrective that the vast majority of sports fans approach sport from the perspective of fandom. And they would do themselves a favor by turning that off and thinking about the perspective of the athlete's approach to sport. And sport as a creative space, a space of pleasure, a space of joy. I've seen a lot of...
I thought it was about winning and capitalism.
right. Labor. And so much of the athletes' rights people in the college sports space right now are talking about sport as labor. But sport can be many things at once. Mm-hmm. And I like to think of sport as performance art. And I think that really places the purpose of sport, I mean, yeah, with the athletes rather than those who are consuming the beauty and the brilliance that athletes are producing, if we're talking about athletes as laborers. There's a third too.
Yep. So I like the sport as performance art. That's sticky. Okay, I like that. All right, give us number three.
Thanks. The third is to think global and think local and think global when you're exploring a sports moment or a sports story or a sports phenomenon. And a lot of my work again is on American college sports. And I think it's so useful to go locally to an individual institution, to one campus, and see how things play out on the ground. That the kind of national battles or conversations that we see become more complex or bring more color. We're able to understand how things are actually affecting the people who work in intercollegiate athletics, the people who coach, the people who play, when we go to the individual campus. Mm-hmm. And then what's happening in that local case really illustrates, shines better light on what's going on nationally. So first think local, also think global. So much of what I see being done in the US sports space is very insular. It's very domestic. And I think we gain so much by stepping out of the US context to think, okay, what actually is going on elsewhere in the world? And why is this different in the US? Historians are often just so reluctant and kind of put off by people talking about American exceptionalism. But if we want to talk about American exceptionalism, we can in the space of college sports. It's the only place in the world where we have elite sports built in schools. It's the only place in the world that's clung to the myth. Some call it an ideology. I call it a myth or a fraud of amateurism. Mm-hmm. It's the only place in the world where we have a multi-billion dollar sports industry operating in higher education. It's the only place in the world where school sport has been defined as a civil right, right? So that's Title IX. And it's why the world's athletes, the world's elite athletes come to play in the collegiate system in the US. Because the system we have in place offers those athletes the best facilities in the world because it's elite sport in schools, it's amateur, but it's billions of dollars. So the facilities on American college campuses are better than professional sports facilities.
Yes, I've seen that.
I mean, it should be giving us pause. So both the local and the global to understanding a national phenomenon, I think, is a fun way to think about the current moment too.
It is. And, I'm thinking with the pandemic right now and locally how the University of Minnesota is handling our sports versus ASU versus Alabama versus small liberal arts college. But then around the globe, there's no college sports. So this is not a consideration. It's just not on the table. So I like this idea of the thread throughout your three sticky ideas is really about broadening our perspectives, right? Thinking about our bodies different, thinking about fandom differently, thinking about local and global sports differently, and thinking critically about those three things, I think is a really great takeaway for us today. So thank you so much. Do you have a final thought as we wrap up Tucker Center Talks for today, Dr. Jackson?
I do. First of all, thank you. But I think the other thing that underscores my approach is a playfulness. We can be more playful in the way we think about ideas. And it's fun to question things we take for granted or assumptions throughout history. And as long as we're really responsible and careful and do our work and, you know, cast a wide net to think about all the various ways we could try to understand why a certain thing has happened in the past or in the current moment, as long as we bring care, I think it's perfectly acceptable to bring a playfulness to our scholarship as well.
Well, that is a sticky idea, because typically academic thought and playfulness are not used in the same sentence. So you heard it here first on Tucker Center Talks with Dr. Victoria Jackson, historian at ASU. Thank you so much for joining us today. And in the next segment, we're going to hear from fellow disruptors, Drs. Lowe, LaBelle, and Peguerero, on their take on the current disruptions to the dominant model of sport. Welcome to our disruptors segment with the original disruptors, Drs. Lowe, Peguerero, and LaBelle. Disruptors is a campaign and a movement that highlights why disruptions to the normative model of sport created by and for men that privileges men and male athletes is important. In this segment of Disruptors, we will draw attention to people, organizations, and events that disrupt the status quo. So let's start with a major disruption and do a little roundtable of why this matters for women in sport. Recently, in U.S. American sport, many of the professional athletes and professional leagues had boycotts in protest of the recent police shootings of Black men and in support of the Black Lives Matter movement, and had decided not to play games. This is unprecedented in the scope of which it occurred. So why does this matter in terms of disruptors and women's sport?
Yeah, I can jump in. I mean, August 26 was an unprecedented day. We had four leagues boycott postpone games. And athletes are waking up to their collective power in a lot of ways. I think we're seeing that standing up for change and social justice has become bigger than sport. And in a lot of ways, women athletes are the ones who have led us to this point and showed us how to use this power and really turned this time into a movement, not a moment. So I stole that from Twitter, but I think that's a really nice way to capture it. I don't know if I can jump into some of the numbers, but I think we're starting to see that 69% of sports fans are really expecting athletes to be involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. 72% believe that athletes provide a unique view and an important influence. The pendulum has shifted dramatically on this. And again, it's important to underscore that the leadership of women athletes, WNBA in particular, has been leading this advocacy for the last 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we look at the WNBA as the leaders. I mean, they weren't the first league this time to suspend their games, but the fact that they've dedicated their entire season to social justice and to say her name, I think it lets the other leagues, makes it easier for the men to do it, right? Because they've done the hard work. And we've seen this all the way along, that the WNBA athletes and women athletes in the activism space are leading, and it's a bigger risk for them. that's why I think it's a disruption. Like, they have a lot more to lose than the male athletes who are doing this, right? And they're continuing to be committed to it. And it's got to be emotionally tiring for them, given the schedule they're still playing and the toll this takes on them. And so to watch them suspend their games and hold a vigil was amazing to me. And so I do see it as a huge disruption. The numbers that we look at, if we look at the what it did for attention to the WNBA, it increased their media exposure in those sort of 2 days, the 26th and 27th, 2,000%. Right. So, wow. So why does this, you know, why does this matter for women's sports? So the social activism is bringing a lot of attention to them. Like their share of voice went up on social, like they got 170 some thousand tweets that were going about them in those days. So while it's not specifically about them as athletes or about the league and the play of the players, it brings such visibility to them that is bringing potentially new fans and new individuals to appreciate both the women and their work, but also them as athletes as well.
I think it's important to underscore your point, Dr. Peguero, is that I fear in this space that the male athletes, now we see the MLB or the NBA and some professional male athletes doing what the women have been doing, but the men are getting more visibility. So I think it's really important that everybody who cares about women in sport keep pushing forward this idea that, wait a minute, the women have been doing it first and they are leading the way. And let's not forget that the most marginalized people in our society are leading this charge. And we should not forget that. Dr. Lowe, what were you going to add?
Well, I think this fits nicely with what you're saying, which is Naomi Osaka. You know, I mean, when the WNBA launched their, is it not a boycott? In fact, it is, and you
like
can correct me.
I would use strike versus right? boycott, yeah.
It's more accurate. But Naomi Osaka on her own, right? Individual athlete in a sport that is an individual sport, and coming forward in two languages, by the way, right? And owning that her first identity is as a Black woman, and deciding not to play her match in order to also bring attention to the racial injustice and the issue that the WNBA has done such a fabulous job of raising awareness around. But I particularly think she is a disruptor in this space because, as you said, Nicole, what other male athlete is doing this, right? I think back to Arthur Ashe, and that's about it in tennis, right? And it's been an awfully long time since Arthur Ashe was around to be an activist. So for a young woman like Naomi Osaka, who is at the top of her game, certainly, but very, very young and new to the sport, talk about risk, like Anne said, right? The risk that she could be posing for herself, potentially with sponsors, certainly with the organizing body, the USTA. But in fact, her example prompted the USTA to pay attention to the issue and to deal with it in, I think, a way that perhaps they would not have had she not taken a stand.
Hmm. I wonder what
Coco Gauff is another example too of someone really young and was leading back in June. And she doesn't have the sponsorship portfolio certainly of a Naomi Osaka either. And so you're just starting to see it almost the leadership within tennis is starting to kind of trickle down as well, which is really, really neat to see.
And it's so interesting that it's so young, right? I mean, we all know that Serena has been put through so much over the course of her career. So I'm not necessarily saying that she has a place here, although I would love to see it. But the youth of it, right? I think that's really, that stands out to me, again, in the disruptor space, in the sense that these young women are, they just have a whole different set of expectations. And that is something that is truly going to create change because they won't accept the status quo, the default mode. They just won't accept it. They don't think of themselves as less than, they don't think they need to be quiet. They're going to take a stand, and that's what we're seeing. So definitely something to look to.
And I wonder if in a way, and I'm sure I'm not the first to think of this, but if this isn't a byproduct of Title IX here in the U.S., is that these young women, and you know, if you follow the Tucker Center, you've heard someone in the Tucker team say in one or two generations, we've gone from girls hoping there was a team to girls hoping they'd make the team. And now we're in almost a third generation of young women expecting to play, have the opportunity to play, to be equals to their male counterparts. And I'm wondering if this activism isn't an offshoot of that, that we are at an unprecedented disruptive moment for young women as a byproduct of Title IX to find their voices.
Yeah, I mean, having taught classes in that space particularly, where I've been incredibly shocked to hear women in my classes tell me they've never been discriminated against. You know, I didn't understand that. And that definitely is something I've heard from this younger generation. But what that now is translating to is when they experience it, they're not okay with it, right? And they're pushing back. Or they just don't see those imaginary lines that women of our generation wouldn't cross, right? Because we were just asking for permission and just so deeply grateful for the opportunity to participate and to be included, et cetera. And this generation, these two generations, they are of a whole different mindset in that space, Nicole. And I would like to think, as someone who's worked in this area for a long time, that Title IX has had a lot to do with it. So yeah, that, mm-hmm. that would be a positive for us to believe.
Absolutely. What other ways haven't we touched on that we might want to talk about why this is important in terms of a disrupting force in this space before we move on to maybe the disruptor of the day?
I would say that there's a potential disruptive opportunity here around marketing for women's sport. I think we're seeing more and more examples just around the accountability that's really being demanded, not only by athletes, by consumers. And in terms of disruptions, I think this could have a really major impact on how and where marketing and sponsorship dollars are going to be spent moving forward. Just because fans are really embracing this activism and women athletes have really set themselves up to, again, be leaders in this space. But I think the marketing and the accountability that comes with that could have a really dramatic shift.
Yeah, Katie, I think, you know, the survey that came out this week from Nielsen about that sort of also said that fans want the brands to be socially responsible. So, hey, brands who are out there listening right now, this is an awesome opportunity. We've got fans who are demanding athletes be influencers and demanding that the brands are socially responsible. Why do these two not come together more and put the money into women's sport? Because this is where the value is. You're both going to get the fans. You're getting connecting with them where you can, which is, you know, through women's sport, but also about something they care about. So this to me is a disruptor, not just marketing, but it's a massive investment opportunity for these brands.
Yeah, there was an NBC Universal poll that came out this week too. It said 81% are more likely to buy from or use brands that help others when it's needed most. And 72% of consumers, so almost three quarters, are going to be more thoughtful about the brands they support going forward. So those are some really big numbers to be mindful of going forward, particularly as Anne says, in investment opportunities.
Well, and then you add to it that we do know that this younger generation is more value driven. They are more conscious consumers. So yeah, if you want as a brand to meet them where they are, this is the strategy that you're going to have to employ. So yeah, both of those are incredibly important. Like you said, Anne, if you're paying attention as a brand, absolutely great opportunity.
And it's the athletes they follow, right? So it's the athletes who are leading this, and that's where the value is. So really, you know, if you're out there and you represent these athletes, I hope that the brands are talking to you. And if you're a brand looking for an opportunity, find yourself the agents of these women. These women athletes that we're talking about are the ones you want to make the partnerships with.
So in a weird twist of fate, if we're talking about, like I said before, so women athletes have been the least visible, the least powerful, the least paid in the space. And now they're taking up the issues of fighting social and racial injustice and shouldering the burden of the movement, which seems ironic in and of itself. But then because they might be the benefactors in terms of recognition, sponsorship, marketing dollars, sustaining leagues, bringing in new fans. So it's this weird dichotomy of women, and in the WNBA, made up largely of Black women, who are bringing voice and visibility to the issue. Maybe they might actually benefit, which would be amazing. So do you have any thought on that?
There's no question that they're benefiting. And I think the key is you look at Renee Montgomery, right? And what she's been doing since she stepped out of the WNBA this season. You look at Chinne Agumake. You know, her brand is definitely one that is getting considerable attention. And I just mean personal brand. Who is Chinne? You know, she's now the headliner on a WNBA, or no, that's Renee. So we have a WNBA weekly on the NBA TV, which is being led by Renee Montgomery. And then we have Chinne with her own show, Chinne and Golic Jr., I believe, that, you know, that hasn't happened before either. And both of these women, like you said, Black women leading in this space, athletes, it is definitely a different time, no question about it. And that's, you're absolutely right, Nicole, to think about, you know, how it was before, women just trying to get attention. And now we have the most marginalized of all women getting getting the most attention. There's definitely an irony there.
Yeah. And did I see that Candace Parker is also an NBA analyst? So she's doing a double duty role while in the wobble. That's unprecedented. Like, you're announcing while you are actually in season.
Yeah, it's been phenomenal. I mean, those kinds of things, those spaces where we're starting to see, especially the former or the current even WNBA players, the places where they are engaging, right? And like you said, even while they're playing, they're not waiting for their playing career to be over. That's another example of disruption, because they're moving forward with some of these career moves while they're continuing to play. Which is not, it's definitely unprecedented, but you got to strike when the iron is hot, right? So if these opportunities are coming Absolutely. Their way, they got to take advantage.
Yeah.
I sort Katie, of wonder if we're not seeing this sort of entrepreneurship thing, right? We've been talking a bit about this. We saw it with the US women's soccer team. And I'm wondering, like, do these women athletes, like, you don't have a choice, right? You're kind of, you've got to always fight for your space and your attention. And now it's like, okay, maybe we're finally seeing an entrepreneurial mindset of, we are going to get some attention. What can I turn that into? Whereas, you know, a lot of male athletes, the big contracts just arrive, right? So their playing contract, their shoe contract's enough. They don't have to be entrepreneurial. Now we're seeing them, like you said, creating their content, being on other shows, putting out clothing lines. And so it's like, we're getting the attention. The attention's coming to our sport, but as an individual, where's my entrepreneurial opportunity? So we're seeing that. And I don't think we see that the same way at male athletes.
No, it's becoming a livelihood. I mean, so Nancy, you were talking, Natasha Cloud came to mind too. I mean, yeah. She basically got a Converse deal based largely on the visibility that she got from her social activism. And to Anne's point, I think if you look at some of the things that Sue Bird and they've completely turned this into a revenue stream in some ways with the attention that they're getting and the different entrepreneurial strategies that they're rolling out on almost a daily basis, it seems. But the visibility that they're getting from that will set their careers up far past, I'm sure, their athletic careers. So it's great to see.
I think the Natasha Cloud one is an awesome example. She got a shoe contract for a year she's not playing.
Yeah.
Right? So What's that contract about? That contract's about her activism, her brand, right? She's not stepping foot on a court, so she's not going to sell Converse basketball shoes by playing this year. They've signed her for everything else she's bringing to the table.
And you've got Maya Moore too, who's got an HBO documentary coming out again in a year that she's not playing. So they're getting the attention, and it's leading to some pretty big opportunities.
And I think that's why we like to do this disruptor series, because these events in and of themselves, just one by one, are disruptions. But when we frame them and put them all together and start understanding that these disruptions together will lead to larger, hopeful disruptions in the status quo, that's why we want to draw attention with this segment of Tucker Center Talks, Disruptors. So we want you to join us, those that are listening. We want you to join us in drawing attention to disruptions in sport that disrupt the male-dominated model of sport. or that benefits women's sport or female athletes by using the disruptors, H-E-R-S, hashtag in your social media. So check back with us in 2 weeks' time as we talk about additional disruptors in sport. As we conclude this episode of Tucker Center Talks, I want to give a big shout out to all my colleagues who appeared on this episode with me today, Drs. Jackson, Lowe, LaBelle, and Peguerrero. Thank you for sharing your insights and expertise. I'd love to hear from you, so tweet us at Tucker Center or at With Sports, or to me directly at Dr. Sports Psych. Check out our website at tuckercenter.org and follow us on Facebook or Instagram. You can find the show notes with links and resources to this episode at wispsports.com. Look for the Tucker Center Talks tab, where you will find Tucker Center Talks and many more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. That's a wrap for episode 16 of Tucker Center Talks. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.